First case is number 23-10833, Martinelli Barakal versus Attorney General of the United States et al. Mr. Carrillo. Oh, okay. We'll give him a minute. Oh, it's okay. I didn't notice the... You may begin when you're ready. I'm sorry, I didn't know if we were waiting for one more person.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. May it please the court, my name is Charlie Carrillo. I represent Mr. Ricardo Alberto Martinelli Barakal. Your Honor, we're here before the court because Mr. Martinelli has Article III standing. I'm gonna focus on the determinative effect of Mr. Heineman's two letters, which influenced the actions of Panama officials to further prosecute Mr. Martinelli for alleged crimes before his extradition, to establish traceability and redressability as elements of Article III standing. Mr. Martinelli also has standing under the U.S.-Panama Extradition Treaty. The U.S., as a surrendering state, could not have objected or could not have waived his objection to the treaty violation because Mr. Heineman is complicit in the treaty violation. The State Department, through Mr. Heineman, influenced and gave a green light to to Panama's officials to prosecute Mr. Martinelli for additional crimes before his extradition, as evidenced by these two letters that Mr. Heineman wrote, which are considered government actions.
Can I ask you an initial question about that? You keep referring to Mr. Heineman's letters, and I understand that Mr. Heineman wrote the letter, but the U.S. State Department adopted his position, so that is the position of the U.S. government. How does that affect the argument that you're making today?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. The reason why I'm saying that it's not valid that the adoption of the U.S. Embassy is because it's unlawful, because Mr. Heineman was complicit. On December 12th of 2019, Mr. Heineman wrote a letter to a non-diplomatic Panamanian official stating that the rule of specialty did not apply to Mr. Martinelli. At that time, he wasn't prosecuted, but they continued the process. They started prosecuting him based on that letter. In other words, that letter put in motion or triggered Panama's prosecution or indiscriminative prosecution of Mr. Martinelli. So therefore, he was complicit to it. Then the second letter that
isn't that always didn't the Attorney General of Panama write to the U.S. to inquire about the status of the rule of specialty, meaning that prosecution was already being contemplated at that time?
Your Honor, no, she did not. It was a verbal inquiry that she did. It was communications that they had on October 17 of 2019. If they were having communications on October 17 of 2019, both Heineman and the Attorney General knew the binding effect of the treaty and knew the limitations and the protections of the rule specialty enshrined or set forth in Article 8 of the treaty. Therefore, they are both aware of it. Heineman should have told the Panama, you should have filed a formal waiver of the rule specialty so we can consider it according to U.S. law as the treaty states, instead of accepting this verbal inquiry and say, hey, it doesn't apply to Mr. Martinelli's case without any legal analysis and based on highlighted events that occurred in Panama. Also,
going back to Judge Branch's question, though, is there any authority that says the U.S. State Department could not have ratified and adopted Mr. Heineman's position?
Yes.
As affecting a waiver of the...
Yes, it's the treaty, Your Honor. As the Supreme Court in Loper Bright state, that we have to look at the law. We can't give them deference. In this situation, the treaty is clear on the provisions and also on the way that extradition requests are done. A waiver is done the same manner and form as an extradition request. So therefore, the treaty stands as the law, because the treaty is the law of the United States.
Does the treaty set forth the process, though, for waiving the rule of specialty?
Yes, it does. It does. And actually, it's combined. Actually, Mr. Heineman is the one that created the process for the request of waivers between the United States and Panama.
So it's not the treaty. It's the process that Mr. Heineman created.
It's both, because the process that Mr. Heineman created mirrors the treaty. In other words, the treaty is clear that you need to provide evidence of criminality. You have to do a legal analysis. For example, Article 7 of the treaty states that you can't grant an extradition if it violates the statute of limitations, which is the case here, because it violates the statute of limitations because the crimes that Panama is prosecuting Mr. Martinelli occurred between 2009 to 2014. So therefore, when in 2019 he wrote that letter, the statute of limitations already lapsed. So he couldn't write that letter. The treaty, if you analyze it, if he did an analysis of the treaty, he could never issue a waiver of the rule of specialty. He could never object to the treaty violation because of the treaty. The treaty is the law of the land.
But aren't all your clients' rights derivative of the rights of the United States?
Your Honor, in Rocher and also on U.S. v. Herbage, it states that when you're talking about the rule of specialty, there's two parties, the person extradited and the surrendering state. But here, the surrendering state is complicit. There's no waiver that the United States received to consider or to do analysis on. They just issued the letter blindly. It was a broad letter with no legal analysis, with no foundation in legal analysis, to state that Mr. Martinelli can be further prosecuted for a crime that occurred before his extradition. And what I'm trying to say is that the State Department or the embassy can never adopt a letter that's unlawful. The United States has to respect the law. Heineman's letter is not above the treaty. So therefore, the United States did not waive its right to object to the treaty violation because Mr. Heineman was complicit.
You brought up Loper Bright, but as I'm sure you're aware, the level of deference that we provide to the United States executive branch in this sort of situation is dramatically greater than anything that Chevron ever provided for ordinary administrative interpretations, right?
I understand, Your Honor, but what I'm just saying that is that because of the treaty, the waiver or the letter that Heineman wrote, the two letters, the one dated on December 12th and the one dated on October 29th, should never have been issued because in that time he was violating the treaty. Specifically, the October 29 letter, Panama never asked for it. Panama, in October 8th of 2020, asked the embassy, can Heineman speak on behalf of the United States? The embassy responded in the affirmative. The embassy unilaterally attached Heineman's letter, and Heineman falsely stated in the letter saying, this letter is in response to your question regarding the applicability of the rule of specialty in Mr. Martinelli's case. They didn't ask for it. All the documentation that we provided the court states that Panama only asked, does Heineman speak for the United States? And the U.S. Embassy in the affirmative responded. So that's the reason why I'm saying it's just a unilateral decision from Heineman to Panama that influenced them on their decision to further prosecute Mr. Martinelli.
But it was then endorsed by the United States, as you just said.
It was endorsed. It's stated in the letter, in the diplomatic letter, that it was endorsed. But I'm here arguing that the United States could never have adopted that letter because it was unlawful. Heineman did not follow the procedures established in the Foreign Affairs Manual, established in the Foreign Affairs Handbook, not according to the treaty. In other words, there's no process, no formality that Heineman followed to write those two letters. Therefore, the United States can't adopt something that's unlawful.
So suppose we say you're right. Suppose we say, okay, this was unlawful, the U.S. government shouldn't have done that. How does that get your client any relief that he ultimately is seeking? If we say the U.S. government got it wrong, ultimately you're trying to prevent Panama from convicting your client. If we rule against the United States, how does that then provide you with any relief against Panama? Our Lewis case says it must be the effect of the court's judgment on the defendant, which is the U.S. government, not an absent third party, here, the government of Panama, that redresses the plaintiff's injury, whether directly or indirectly.
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I just wanted to say that how it's going to redressability is going to occur. If we have a favorable decision, the defendants have to notify Panama because it's a treaty partner. As soon as the Ministry of Foreign Affairs gets the favorable judgment, it will notify the correspondent authority, which is the trial court, and also the prosecution. In Panama's law, there is Article 548, which states that a extradited individual cannot be further prosecuted without the consent of the surrendering country, here being the United States. If we get a favorable decision here, that means that Mr. Heineman's two letters are set aside, and therefore he can get redressability. Also, we have to focus on how these two letters had a determinative effect on the decision that Panama chose to further prosecute Mr. Martinelli for further crimes before the
Article 548, as I read it, allows the Panamanian government to void the prosecution, but I don't see how it requires that. Isn't that still within the discretion of the Panamanian government?
It's not, in my point of view, it's not, because it's compelling, because in that same article says if the surrendering state does not consent, you can't prosecute the individual. So if we have a favorable decision, that means that Mr. Heineman's letters are set aside, and for Panama's perspective, there's no consent from the United States.
That would be if Panama agreed with the United States' interpretation of the treaty.
Yes, it's a perfect example would be the Samuel Beckman Frye case. In that case, in particular, the Department of Justice wanted to add five additional charges. The Bahamas did not issue a waiver before trial. The Department of Justice had to withdraw. In other words, the United States had to respect the treaty. Independently, that the Department of Justice wanted to further prosecute Mr. Beckman Freed, they couldn't, because they had to respect it. The same process will occur in Panama, because Heineman's letter had such a coercive effect on Panama. The reverse will be similar. A favorable judgment will have the same effects in Panama, just as the letter of Heineman did to prosecute Mr. Martinelli.
Thank you. If the panel has no other questions, I'll save
my time
for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Ben Lewis for the United States. This is a case where the standards for traceability and redressability should be very high. Panama is an independent sovereign, and we're talking about the factors that go in to prosecutorial and judicial decision-making. Martinelli has been convicted of money laundering once already, and there's an ongoing prosecution in Panama where Panama has chosen to prosecute an ex-president for corruption at the highest levels of government. Martinelli could today bring a motion under Article 548 alleging a violation of the rule of specialty. He's never been shy about what he wants this court to do, to issue a declaratory judgment that is opining on Panama's treaty obligations. That is precisely the type of redressability theory that has been rejected time and again from both this court and the Supreme Court, and it relies on speculation upon speculation about how Panama would respond. And so we ask this court to affirm the judgment below, and I welcome questions.
There have been obviously rule of specialty challenges before, and I think those situations are probably different because there was not the assent from the U.S. government that at least we arguably have here. But what makes those cases different in terms of once the person is already in the country? Why are those cases any different from a standing perspective on the country doing what the United States says it should?
So I'm not aware of any case exactly like these facts where a country has chosen to prosecute a former ex-president for the type of reasons here. And I think that, I guess my top line answer would be that in those cases, there would be no standing if the plaintiff argue the theory that plaintiffs have here today, which is that a declaratory judgment, if they get a declaratory judgment from this court, then they can bring that to Panama, present that declaratory judgment on the treaty obligation to a non-party, the Panamanian prosecutors and Panamanian judges, and that their argument will be more persuasive. That type of persuasive effect is just off the table for these types of, I think, Article 3 analyses. And I think Lewis makes that particularly clear. In Lewis, the plaintiffs sought a declaratory judgment that was directed at the Attorney General to declare a state preemption law unlawful, such that a minimum wage law would go into effect. And in that case, this court said that that opinion would have only an incidental effect on non-parties, namely the employers, and in particular, that the vast majority of subsequent litigation would take place between employees and employers in state court, and state judges would not be bound by any type of incidental legal determination by a federal declaratory judgment. The same is true here. Panamanian judges would not be bound and would be making an independent judgment about the international treaty obligations and the rule of specialty here. And so there's just no theory of redressability that would allow the injury here, which plaintiff has quite clearly said in paragraph 18 of the complaint, is the end and termination of his prosecution. There's no sense that there would be any likelihood of redressability of that injury.
Opposing counsel would argue that Panamanian law is so clear that once the U.S. government reverses its position, presumably, that Panamanian courts would be bound by that. I assume you have a different interpretation of Panamanian law.
Yeah, I don't want to put myself forward as an expert on Panamanian law here, but I would ask this court to exercise a great deal of caution before opining on that type of issue. I think the best evidence comes from Exhibit TT that plaintiffs have, which is this Article 548 provision of the treaty. And what it says is that there are three independent ways in which the rule of specialty would not apply as Panama understands it. The first is express consent by the sending state. But the second is the circumstance that's most applicable here, which is a circumstance where a person has stayed in the country after extradition for at least 30 days. And the reason why that, the third theory is where the individual itself consents, which is not applicable here. But the reason why that kind of interpretation of the treaty makes sense is that if someone chooses to stay in the country after extradition, then the extradition agreement has run its course. What happens next between that person and that country and their laws is between them and that country. It has nothing to do with the United States.
Are you saying that if the United States thought that a prosecution in a country was inappropriate because of the rule of specialty, that even the United States, if someone brought a case here saying this is a violation of the rule of specialty and the United States agreed, are you saying that the position would still be, well, we can't stop the other country's courts from doing what they're going to do, so you don't have standing?
So I think that the circumstance under which that occurred would be if, I guess, you're imagining an APA action where the United States has taken a position that there is a violation of the rule of specialty here. If there's agreement,
there's
I'm not sure that there would be a challenge, but I guess we have evidence from our courts on what that kind of situation would look like. The vast majority of extradition cases here involve situations where the United States is trying to prosecute someone who has been sent from a foreign country to the United States. And in those cases, in a circumstance where a foreign country objects, the courts do an independent analysis of whether or not there has been a violation of the rule of specialty. In those circumstances, the criminal defendant argues that there were, and the court does an independent analysis. That's precisely the type of challenge that Martinelli should be bringing in Panamanian courts and has chosen instead to try to get this court to issue a declaratory judgment that kind of leverages his motion and makes it more powerful. I would encourage this court not to try to parse the record to look exactly how kind of prosecutorial and judicial motivations might change if there were a declaratory judgment. But if you do, I think plaintiff's theory as a practical matter fails on its own terms. There are a couple of levels of speculation here about what would happen next if the United States did choose to raise an objection under the rule of specialty. The first, I think, as we discussed, is the kind of judicial judgment that would be made, the independent judgment by Panamanian courts. But the second, I think, critically, is if there is a disagreement between Panama and the United States, that is exactly the type of diplomatic disagreement that happens every day. And I think it's extremely speculative to think that there would not be further kind of discussions or coordination that would occur after the fact. The third, I think, quite critically, is that, of course, just because there is if the United States says there's a violation of the rule of specialty, that does not mean that a prosecution cannot be brought. What it means is that there would be a discussion about whether the United States would waive the rule of specialty. And again, that's, I think, considerably speculative to think that there is no possibility of waiver here. A plaintiff, I think, both in his briefing and here today at the podium, asserts that a waiver would be impossible because of domestic statute of limitations reasons. That was kind of beside the point in the briefing because, of course, what the State Department did here was not issue a waiver, but just to be responsive to that concern, I think it both misrepresents the treaty as a matter of international law and kind of misrepresents our domestic criminal statute of limitations. As a matter of the treaty, he relies on Article 7 to make this argument, but that argument is about extradition. It's not about waivers. The entire point of a waiver is to say that despite the language of the treaty, that we are choosing not to raise an objection under the treaty. And so the terms of, I think, and the argument he's making is a little confused on its own terms, but of course, just as a matter of federal criminal law, there are tolling provisions that are a litany of tolling provisions in the federal statutes of limitations, and many of which would potentially be applicable here. If the court wanted a kind of a thorough analysis of what that kind of statute of limitations would look like, we'd be happy to provide supplemental briefing, but we think that that provides kind of no obstacle to the type of factual speculation here. So I think both as a legal matter and as a factual matter, it relies on speculation. I think the argument that plaintiffs are making here relies significantly on speculation about what would happen next, but kind of just to take a step back, I think the circumstances here, I think, in the domestic context are those that would typically be dealt with by younger abstention because there's an ongoing prosecution, which we don't want the court to intervene. The same type of comedy interests, I think, are very, very persuasive in this context in an international perspective. Again, we have a circumstance in which an independent sovereign is choosing to prosecute an ex-president. There's an ongoing prosecution there, and I would just encourage the court to be quite cautious and very strict in its application of the traceability and redressability principles as it considers the case today. If there are no further questions, I urge this court to affirm.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the defendant states that there's no way that there'd be redressability. I just want to remind the court that in Lewis, the standard was not a guarantee of redressability, but the whether a favorable judgment will have a significant likelihood of redress. So it's not how the government's saying that there's no redress. In actuality, Heinemann's letter gave or made no redress or no recourse for President Martinelli to pursue any type of individual rights in Panama because the letter had such a powerful coercive effect that he has no recourse in Panama. We have to remind what this court said in Puentes. We extradited this individual. We have a right to protect that individual's rights and for him not to be indiscriminately prosecuted. As the United States, we have to honor our international treaties.
So there are two criminal prosecutions going on in Panama, and your client has been convicted in one of them. The government has argued, therefore, your challenge on that front is moot. If you were to achieve a favorable decision in this court, what effect, if any, would this have on the completed prosecution and conviction?
Your Honor, we would have to, in Panama, there would be something, it's called a revision. It's similar to a 2255 motion based like, for example, on a Supreme Court decision that provides a new right or there's new evidence that wasn't present in the trial. It would, sua sponte, the court would have to consider it or by motion of the defendant here, Mr. Martinelli, would have to file, and that's how it opens the case again for the court to consider. But going back to the topic.
But again, so that then would be left up to the Panamanian court's discretion.
There's no guaranteed, and the standard for redressability is not the guaranteed, it's just a significant likelihood. Just having a favorable decision in this court, I give us the opportunity to file that in that court for it to be considered. I can't guarantee that it will be in our favor, but the standard is a significant likelihood.
How is it gives you the opportunity to file, but how can you say that you have a significant likelihood of prevailing?
Because of Article 548. 548 states that it limits or restricts the prosecution of an individual that is extradited without the surrendering state's consent. If Heinemann's letters are set aside, there is no consent in the perspective of Panama. Therefore, 548 will compel the court to, one, annul his conviction, and two, dismiss any pending criminal charges. And just to clarify for the court, it's just not two cases that he's been prosecuted. It's over four cases that can clearly indicate the indiscriminative prosecution of the Republic of Panama to my client, Mr. Martinelli. And all this is, there's a direct or fairly traceable link between the prosecution and Mr. Heinemann and the Department of State. Like I said before, they were complicit because on December 12th, there was no prosecution at that time, and he said it was okay. He issued the same letter once again on October 29. The only difference is because it was done by diplomatic channels. Why would the State Department issue the same letter twice? It was done just to try to cure or to rectify what they did in December 12th, but the damage is already done. On October 29th of 2020, Mr. Martinelli had four criminal cases. He couldn't leave the country. He had to register. Had to be registered in the court every 15 days. In other words, what Heinemann wrote in that letter was inaccurate, it was not correct, and pretty much it was a direct link for his injuries. So therefore, complying with the traceability and redressability requirement of Article 3.
I understand your client's deep frustration with the process, but at the most basic level, speaking only for myself, what you're asking the court to do is say to the United States government executive branch that the decision that it has endorsed is unlawful. And excuse me, that's a very big step in this arena. And it's not typically the sort of thing that courts are inclined to tell the executive branch in matters of foreign affairs. I understand your point that the U.S. can't endorse what your client sees as an unlawful communication to the Panamanian government, but that I'm not familiar with any case where we have done anything like this.
Yes, Your Honor, there's one case. It's called Cosgrove versus Winnie. It's a Supreme Court decision from 1890. In that case, the court told the Department of State, you can't prosecute him because you have it wrong. It's unlawful.
So I told the Department of State, you can't prosecute this person here. A court did not tell the Department of State, you can't make this communication to a different government.
It's not the communication. The communication was unlawful. Going back to the treaty states that all communications between Panama and the United States based on this extradition treaty has to be through diplomatic channels. Heinemann did not use diplomatic channels to issue that letter. Every action that he did, he knew that he was doing something wrong. He knows better because he's the one that created the process. I'm just stating that the United States, regardless, executive branch and the judicial branch supposed to check by the Constitution, the executive branch, the United States can't adopt a letter that's unlawful. An action that's unlawful is the United States can't do it. In other words, just because it's unlawful, the letter that Heinemann wrote, this court should decide that to remand this proceedings back, reverse the decision of the trial court so we can go for further proceedings and put our case on before the district court. Once again, what I want to mention back to Heinemann's letter applied the wrong standard according to the treaty. The defendant here stated 548 says that, if he stays longer than 30 days, the treaty is no longer in effect. That's not true. The standard of the treaty is that the extradited individual should have the right to return to the surrendering state. This is the United States is the one that extradited him, so Martinelli should have the opportunity to return to the surrendering state so the rule of specialty does not continue to be applicable, or he can...
Thank you, counsel. You're over your time, and we understand your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.